This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, Mike Murphy and I will host Kay Newman from the group SOAR, or Saving Our Avian Resources. She'll discuss lead poisoning among raptors and other wildlife due to hunting, and how it harms the animal population and the humans who eat the meat. But first, I'm naturally with your environmental news headlines. TheGuardian.com reports, Russian scientists have now discovered seven giant craters in remote Siberia, a geologist told AFP on Thursday, adding that the mysterious phenomenon was believed to be linked to climate change. All of the craters have been discovered in the remote, energy-rich Yamalo-Nenetsky region in northwestern Siberia. Scientists say that rather than aliens or meteorites, the holes are caused by the melting of underground ice in the permafrost, which has possibly been sped up by rising temperatures due to global warming. As the ice melts, methane gas is released, which builds up under pressure up until an explosion takes place, leading to the formation of a crater. The scientists are still trying to estimate what danger, if any, is posed by the holes. Methane is extremely flammable, and at least one of the craters is situated near an exploited gas deposit. An expedition is planned to the latest crater discovered to determine if it was formed in the same manner. Quote, when they appear, the craters are empty, and little by little, they fill up with water. In the space of 2 or 3 years, they become lakes, and it is difficult to study them, said Vasily Bogoyavlinsky, the deputy director of Oil and Gas Research Institute of the Russian Academy of Sciences. ThinkProgress.org reports, energy-related carbon dioxide emissions flatlined globally in 2014 while the world economy grew. The International Energy Agency reports this mark, quote, the first time in 40 years in which there was a halt or reduction in emissions of the greenhouse gas that was not tied to an economic downturn, end quote. The IEA attributes this remarkable occurrence to, quote, changing patterns of energy consumption in China and OECD countries, end quote. As we think Progress reported last month, China cut its coal consumption 2.9% in 2014, the first drop this century. China is aggressively embracing energy efficiency, expanding clean energy, and shutting the dirtiest power plants to meet its planned 2020 or sooner peak in coal use. As a result, Chinese CO2 emissions dropped 1% in 2014, even as their economy grew by 7.4%. And finally, EcoWatch.com reports, California is currently the only state that requires chemical testing of fracking wastewater and public disclosure of the findings. The Environmental Working Group, or EWG, has completed an analysis of data released by the state during the first year of new reporting requirements. It found that the high levels of the carcinogen benzene in California's fracking wastewater isn't the only thing Californians have to worry about from the state's extensive oil and gas fracking operations and injection of chemical-laced wastewater back into the ground once drilling is completed. The study, Toxic Stew, What's in Fracking Wastewater?, revealed the presence of hundreds of chemicals, including many linked to cancer, nervous system damage, and reproductive disorders. Among the chemicals found in up to 50% of the samples were chromium-6, lead, and arsenic, all linked to cancer and or reproductive damage. The samples also contained thousands of times more radioactive radium than the goals set by the state, along with high levels of nitrate and chloride ions. And in another analysis last month by the Center for Biological Diversity, they found that 98% of the fracking wastewater samples tested exceeded federal and state water safety levels for benzene. The study comes on heels of revelations that almost 3 billion gallons of fracking wastewater was illegally dumped last year into central California aquifers that supply drinking and farm irrigation water, leading to the shutdown of 11 wells in the state's fracking capital of Kern County. Because such a high chemical content is being found in fracking wastewater in the single state where reporting is required, it opens the door to questions about the safety of wastewater being injected into wells in states where it's not required, allowing extraction companies to exercise less concern for what might be leaking into local water supplies. Now, we'll be...
Before we go to our guest, naturally, I do have a short clip to play. So last Thursday, the American Friends Service Committee released a report based on their Move the Money listening project. And this was where they interviewed a bunch of community leaders and organizers about priorities in our budget and, you know, military, say, versus social services. But the environment wasn't totally left out. During the Q&A session, Amarita Burdick asked a question, and Rex Archer from the health department answered. I just want to play that clip right now before we go to our guest.
I noticed that there are a lot of problems that came up, but one of the problems that wasn't mentioned was environmental aspects of effect on our community. And I know that, like, the downtown area is not, it has more sulfur dioxide in the air than is approved by the EPA. While people are trying to take away the regulations and get the EPA to bow out, I know that there are places across town, such as the old nuclear weapons plant, which has a good deal of pollution and which negatively impacts more mainly the poorer areas of this city. What can we do about this?
Dr. Rex Archer of the Kansas City Health Department responds.
You're correct. There are a number of environmental challenges that we have. Some successes, sometimes two steps forward, one step back, but the air was filled with lead, and we had a lot of lead paint in houses, and we're still actually paying for lead exposure that's out there right now that is harming our kids and their ability both to learn. But there's actually very good studies showing that not only is lead a neurotoxin and keeps kids from learning as well as being able to read, graduate from high school, but it also decreases their ability to handle stress and anger without becoming violent. And so that we need to do a lot more on that. There is more efforts going on sustainability. Our city council has focused on a number of sustainability issues and is trying to move forward on many of our buildings that are more LEED standard kind of issues. We actually have Carol Adams here from our Environmental Management Council. That's not the right term. Environmental Health Commission that is working on a lot of those air quality issues. Some of these challenges, though, are the gases can occur over on the other side of the state line, and they come here also, and we do have some issues with asthma. We also know that living within about 300 meters or yards of our busier highways causes a shorter life expectancy and health challenges also. And so, but we, you know, the environmental questions and then there's physical environment, not just air quality. We used to have one of the highest death rates on our highways in Missouri of any state in the country, and then they put the cabling up in between keep people from being able to cross over and have the head-ons, and that tremendously dropped our deaths from those types of accidents. So you've got a whole range of environmental issues we could spend the whole topic time on.
All right, this is Naturally again. I'd like to welcome Ms. Kay Newman to our program.
Hello.
Hi, Kay. How are you?
Good.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I'd like to ask you a few questions about saving our avian resources, SOAR. So what is this program?
So SOAR is a nonprofit. We are located in West Central Iowa, and we do wildlife rehabilitation and education and research. So we take in injured wild birds. We try to fix whatever's wrong with them and release them back into the wild.
Okay, and what are raptors before we get into this?
So raptors are hawks, owls, eagles, and falcons.
Okay.
So the birds, predatory birds, birds that need to eat other animals in order to survive.
Now, what role do you play within SOAR?
So I'm the executive director for SOAR. And so I do most of the hands-on rehabilitation. We have a wonderful group of volunteers that help to transport injured birds and help us, you know, house for a day or two at a time. We have a person that takes care of our web page and our Facebook page, and another, Terry Hofer, who does our educational programming. So most, you know, we are pretty much a volunteer organization all the way around, and so everybody pitches in where we need to have things done.
I wanted to kind of talk about the lead poisoning. There's a problem with eagles being with lead poisoning, and how are they becoming poisoned?
Well, and this is something that we've been working on for about 11 years now.
Wow.
This kind of sort of came to the forefront here in Iowa for wildlife rehabilitators across the state. And so we work with McBride Raptor Project and Wildlife Care Clinic in Ames and another group up in Black Hawk County that work with eagles. And all of us were calling each other in 2004 and going, oh, my gosh, we have eagles coming in sick, dead, and dying from lead poisoning. And that was kind of our wake-up call, but I know there have been many other groups working on this issue for a lot longer than we have. The Raptor Center up in Minnesota has been working on this for probably more than 30 years now. And so eagles come to Iowa in the wintertime. And we're kind of, so if you think about Canada, northern Minnesota, and northern Wisconsin, it's, are you guys still there?
Yes, I hear you.
Okay, good. It gets really cold up there. It's hard to fish. That's mm-hmm. their main, you know, food source. And so they will come south for the wintertime. And they kind of hold up in Iowa. We, you know, oddly enough, we're like, yeah, the Bahamas for bald eagles in January and February and on into March. They'll show up in December.
Mm-hmm.
We have open water. We have river systems that stay open. We have several large dams that will churn water up behind the dam, and that keeps the water open, and so there's easy spots for them to fish.
Mm-hmm.
But it's right during all of our hunting seasons
here
in the state. And so eagles are not above scavenging. You know, if you can find food, the easiest way that you can get the most amount of energy is usually how a predator looks at things. And so a deer carcass you can eat for several days versus, you know, having to catch a fish in the morning and in the evening to keep yourself going. And so if they scavenge on an animal that has been shot with lead ammunition, there are little fragments of lead or actual shot still in the animal, and those little pieces of lead are ingested by the eagles, and they get very sick, and many of them die.
Hmm. So how do you even get to these birds like that have been poisoned? How did they get into your care?
Well, and so there's all sorts of crazy avenues that they get here. The most direct is that someone from the public sees an eagle, and usually these guys, you know, might be standing out in a farm field, and they're just standing there. They'll stand there, and their head will be hanging down, their wings will kind of be drooping. And you know, most people that watch these animals, even casually, can look at one and go, oh, there's something wrong with that guy, you know. And they will call us directly, and we can send a volunteer to check it out. We also really rely on our conservation officers, our wardens are one of the first places that people will call with something like this. And in Iowa, we have county conservation boards. So it's an office, a department within each county that deals with natural resources. And the county conservation board staff are also people that are, some of them are pretty familiar with going out and rescuing these guys. So we absolutely don't pick up an eagle on your own. Call
mm-hmm.
someone who knows what they're doing to get one picked up and brought in. And so those are kind of the main avenues.
Okay, Kay, we're going to take a break, but we will be back very shortly.
Hey, this is your old pal Mike Murphy. Have you ever heard of the San Patricios? They were a group of Irish and other immigrants from Europe who came to this country during the 1840s, only to end up fighting on the Mexican side during the Mexican-American War. They didn't get much press, but for some reason, there's an awful lot of songs about them. This Wednesday from 6 to 8 a.m., be featuring that music with David Rovix, Tim O'Brien, the Elders, the Chieftains, Black 47, and more.
30 millions of people begirding themselves with deadly weapons and falling into antagonistic battle lines. All that was comprehended in one word. War.
The untold story of Irish Wilderness, Missouri, on From Ark to Microchip, Wednesday night at 11:30.
All right, I'd like to welcome you back to Eco Radio. My name is Natural Lee, and I have Kay Newman on the line with us from Iowa, and we're speaking about SOAR, Saving Our Avian Resources. Now, Kay, you just spoke about the eagles, bald eagles, that come to Iowa during the wintertime from Canada, and when a deer is shot with a lead bullet and then they feed on that carcass, then they in turn get lead poisoning. Is there any other way that these eagles can contract the lead poisoning?
Not that we have found it. You have to ingest the lead. You have to eat the lead in order to be poisoned by it. And so when this first started, it was almost like a little CSI investigation. Their main food source is fish. And so that was what we looked at first off to see if there were lead levels in the fish that they were eating. In Iowa, and I'm sure Missouri does this too, because people eat fish also. Mm-hmm. They do a lot of tissue sampling and testing for these kinds of toxins. And really, lead in Iowa is not an issue in fish. And so, thankfully, fish are good. Fish mm-hmm. are safe. And so we started X-raying eagles. The eagles that were coming in, we started X-raying them to see what was in their digestive tract so we could pinpoint a source. And we're finding shrapnel, so little mm-hmm. shards of lead in their stomachs. Shot, which is a little round piece of lead that you would use shot to shoot a pheasant or to shoot a dove or to shoot a turkey. Hmm. You would not use that to shoot a deer. So there's another avenue besides specifically deer. These guys are scavenging out on the landscape, and a turkey looks just as good as a dead deer to them. Mm-hmm. And so any kind of game animal that has been shot with lead shot, lead bullet, or a lead slug would be the source for these guys. So we're finding shrapnel, shot. We actually had one eagle that came in with a 22 bullet, the entire bullet in her stomach.
Wow, and she just ate the whole thing.
Ate the whole thing, yeah. So that would be like a rabbit, something like that, or a squirrel that would be shot with a 22 bullet. And so these guys their eyesight is 10 times as good as ours is. Wow. And so they're very good at finding food, mm-hmm. and dead food to them is all the better. And so wounded animals and actually deer, most people when they hunt deer, they will field dress the animal.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to, drag the whole entire thing out, so they'll mm-hmm. take out the heart, the liver, the lungs, the stomach, and the intestines and leave that behind. And so we've actually x-rayed about 53 gut piles now. Mm-hmm. From deer that have been shot with lead slugs, and we're finding lead fragments in those gut piles. And some of those gut piles, one of them we x-rayed, had more than 100 fragments in the gut pile. Another one had, 80, 60, multiple. So a deer gut pile contains enough lead to kill several eagles.
Oh, my gosh.
Because their digestive system is so good. A tiny little fragment of lead, so like a grain of rice-sized piece of lead ingested by an eagle is enough to kill them. And so that's why these gut piles can be lethal multiple times over.
So are you able to save an eagle that has this in their stomach?
Very rarely. And so just the report just before we started talking was talking about lead impacts on children. And for eagles, it's a neurotoxin. And so one of the first things that it does, it will make their brain swell, affects their vision, ulcerate stomach lining, so they have problems keeping down food, attacks kidneys and liver, and so those organs will tend to shut down. And so when they come in, the first thing we do is run a blood test. We can do that here on site. That will give us their lead levels. If they're over the poisoning threshold, which is 0.2 parts per million in the blood, we'll start chelation treatment for them, which is injections of calcium EDTA twice a day. And that chemical will bind with the lead in their bloodstream and then allow their kidneys to recognize it and excrete it.
Mm-hmm.
So basically you're just kind of trying to cleanse the blood gradually, and it can be up to a four-week process of those injections to get the lead out of their system.
And have you had success cases with that?
Not very many. Usually by the time we get them, we already have organ damage. When they're with the really high lead levels, we're looking at organ damage, and at that point in time, it's very, very difficult. We can't keep food in them because their stomach, their digestive tracts are not working properly. The lower levels, when they come in with the 0.2, 0.4, you know, some of those guys we can get a hold of before there's been major organ damage by the poison and can get those guys back out the door. So really the only solution for this is to prevent it from happening.
Yes, so let's talk about that. Can't save them once they're poisoned, what can we do to keep them?
Yeah, once they're poisoned. And the other issue, too, is we're not going to find them all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there are eels on the landscape that die that no one ever sees.
Mm-hmm.
And so we figure just by band returned rates, so eagles that are out there with bands on them, and the banding lab relies on the public to report birds with bands on them. And so the band return rate for bald eagles is about 15%. So of all the eagles that are out there and banded and available for the public to find, only about 15% of them come in.
Mm.
And so we're figuring we're seeing only about 15% of the lead poison cases that are out there on the landscape. And so that's probably the big concern. But this is an easy one. You know, you guys were talking about several environmental issues that are very difficult to deal with on a very large scale, but this one, hunters can use ammunition that is not made out of lead.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, very pretty straightforward and easy to handle.
Mm-hmm.
Our whole family hunts, and they hunt everything that you're allowed to here in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And since 2004, they have not used any lead ammunition to hunt with at all.
Mm-hmm.
So for the last 11 years, and it hasn't been an issue for them at all. We hunt deer and squirrels and rabbits and doves and pheasants and turkeys, and we just decided that wasn't going to happen, and so they use copper slugs, copper muzzleloader bullets, non-toxic shot for all of the hunting that they do.
Kay, this is Mike. So a couple things about, well, first of all, help us get a sense of, like, the sense of volume here. Like how many eagles come in your inbox a year?
In the inbox. And so it's variable. And so all the wildlife rehabilitators in Iowa are, at this point in time, we're testing every eagle that comes in for lead poisoning, regardless of symptoms. They're all getting tested. Now remember, we're all volunteers, and so we don't get every single one, but we're doing pretty good. Last year we had about 40 eagles come into rehabilitators across the state, and 20 of those were lead poison cases. So that was half of all of our admits.
Wow.
And that's what it's been running for about the last 11 years. It's, you know, some years it's 58%, some years it's 62%, some years it's, you know, 49%. But we're really running right about half of all of our admits for bald eagles here in the state of Iowa come to us because of lead. And so because they've ingested lead. And so that's where the alarm bell starts sounding, because when we look at all of the mortality factors that are out there, you know, electrocution, being hit by a wind turbine, being illegally shot. So we have right now darn close to 300 eagles in our database. 180 of them are there because they ingested lead. And so I think maybe 14 were illegally shot out of that 300. So, you know, illegal shootings are running 8, 10% of the database, whereas as poisoning cases, lead poisoning cases, are running 50%. And so when it's that overwhelming amount of the total admits, that's when we start worrying. If we were seeing, like you said, 2-3 lead poisoning cases a year, we might just chalk that up to, you know, well, things happen out there to these guys. But that's not the case. It's an overwhelming number, and it's poison. So it's not like running into something, you know, or being hit by a car or something like that. This is a systemic poison that bioaccumulates. And so if you recall, bald eagles were on the endangered species list for 30 years because of a chemical that bioaccumulates in their system called DDT. And DDT and lead both interfere with your calcium metabolism. And so we should learn from history, I guess, is the answer there, in that we want to prevent poisoning whenever possible in wild animals.
If I recall correctly, the DDT issue, what that was doing was causing, like, the eggshells to be too thin to be viable?
Yes.
Are there similar things happening with the lead, or
well, that's
not even
an area
getting to reproduce?
So I hear a volunteer to be climbing some eagle nest trees and collecting some eggshells. That could very well be an issue. They've done quite a bit of research on chickens as far as how the lead travels through the body. And lead, since it's mimicking calcium, and that's why they're so worried about humans and children and pregnant women are the two categories. Whenever you talk about lead, those are the two groups of people that they worry about the most, because they have a high calcium demand. They're developing bone, they're growing tissue. And so anything that looks like calcium that enters their body's going to just suck it right up and put it into bone and into the animal. Whereas if you're a grown adult and you ingest calcium, a lot of it's just going to go through you because you don't have a high demand.
Right.
And so what they found with lead is that it can cross the placenta. So it can go from the hen or the mother to the embryo and the egg or the human baby. And so that's certainly scary to me. and I understand why the health departments are working so hard to get lead out of houses. And so you guys know, when we talk about these issues, it's never just one thing. And so when we started working on this eagle issue and finding lead in deer carcasses, we started going, well, if it's in the carcass, most hunters want to eat the animal that they have harvested.
Yes.
And so we started looking at venison, ground venison. And I think we're close to having 60, 70 different packages of ground venison that we've x-rayed, and we're finding lead in about 40% of those.
Wow.
Visible lead fragments on x-ray.
So this is now people are eating this.
This is now a people thing.
Yeah.
And so just like DDT, even though we really languished there and should have been much, much quicker on the ball and not let eagles drop off the map and get down to 500 nesting pair in the lower 48 states, that eventually could have impacted us also, and we digest things differently. We are a much larger animal, and we react to things differently. And so lead, as in your lead-in story here, you know, for children, it can affect their IQ, attention deficit disorders linked to lead levels in children. They don't, you know, get sick and die and have seizures immediately like eagles do.
Mm-hmm.
And so if humans reacted the same way as eagles, we wouldn't be having this discussion, because we would have long gotten it out of that system. We've gotten it out of paint. We've gotten it out of gasoline and solder. And so this is just the next good step, is to get it out of ammunition and get it out of the game meat that a lot of people depend on for a food source.
Yeah, I mean, they got lead out of all those things you just mentioned. Why wouldn't they just lead is a toxin, period. So it just should not be in anything that we use. You know, I just...
Exactly. So, and that one has, it never dreamt that it would become kind of a political question, and so...
It always becomes political.
It always ends up that way. And so we wanted to try to stay out of that as much as possible, and we're trying to work directly with the people that hunt, because people who are hunters already want to be outside mm-hmm. and want to be in the outdoors, and so many of them... you know, love to just watch the animals that are around them when they're out and hunting. And so we know that if we can get this information directly to the hunters and urge them to make good choices, that that might be our very best option to get something done on the ground quickly.
Is that hard to do? How do you outreach to hunters, do you?
Well, and so this is, yeah, and so some states, I was just at a meeting over in Omaha and listened to some of our state directors for our wildlife agency. So in Iowa, we're called the Department of Natural Resources. Missouri is Department of Fish and Game. You know, the agencies that are really, really should be in charge of this sort of thing. Because SOAR, if you guys check out our webpage, soarraptors.org, as we keep repeating, we're volunteers. And so our budget is very, very small. And so we are doing what we can. But it would be so wonderful if every state agency would step up and hire a lead abatement coordinator and have someone that is versed in good education strategies and to get the word out to people. And I know Oregon just did that, and California has a couple people on staff that's their job. They figure out, you know, what's the best way to reach hunters, and, you know, they go to the big deer classic shows and, you know, some of the hunting venues and are there to explain what's happening and to highlight the alternative ammunition that's not made out of lead, which in most cases is superior to the lead form. I know with copper slugs, all of the deer hunters that we know and have talked to, once they have switched from lead slugs to copper slugs, there's no way you could even pay them to go back to the lead slugs, because the copper ones are more accurate. They fly a little bit farther, and the hunters have the opinion that they're much more efficient at killing the deer immediately for them, which is what most hunters want to have happen.
So it's a win-win.
Yeah, it should be. It should be a win-win.
Well, not for the deer, but...
not for the deer. There you go. But for everybody else.
Yeah. So is there a difference in price that's, you know, is it?
It depends on, yeah, and so this is the other thing that we've discovered, that some hunters are not very good shoppers. I don't know if those two skill sets.
Maybe they, I won't say that, yeah.
Don't coincide. They tend to want to go, like, the day before the season opens and buy the ammunition that they need. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, like, now is the time to go buy a winter coat because they're all on sale. You
right.
can get a $200 winter coat for $50 right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they do a little prep work ahead of the season, there are sales. We bought copper slugs, which normally are about $15 a box. We did the wise shopper thing. We found them for $9 a box in one location, but it was in July. It mm-hmm. wasn't in, you know, December or October. And so I think if they shop around, they can find them for cheaper than the lead sometimes. A lot of the shot, the non-toxic shot, especially for doves, that's a real small size shot that you would use. The steel shot or the non-toxic shot is the same price as the lead. There's a real variety. But having a whole entire family that likes to go out hunting, I know what it costs them to buy their licenses, to buy their guns.
Mm-hmm.
My husband has $200 boots, so the deer won't smell his feet. And
wow.
So, yeah, you know, $15 for a box of slugs seems relatively inconsequential
right.
compared to the whole gamut of things that hunters spend money on.
Well, and the truth of the matter is, it spend that $15 because that's your life and your family's life you're talking about.
Yeah,
because you're
exactly.
going to eat that deer. You're not just shooting that deer. You're going to eat that
right.
deer. So, I mean, it just... So,
yep, most hunters that we talk to, when they start realizing the big circle, they're like, yeah, we're on it. We're buying, you know, and rifle bullets are a little more expensive, but I have a gal, friend of mine, that hunts mule deer up in North Dakota, and she bought her box of copper rifle bullets, and I think they were about $50 for the box, but she said, well, this will last me probably 5 years.
Wow.
Because she's going to go out and, you know, shoot once or twice a year, get her mule deer, and she's good to go. And so when you stretch it out over the life of the ammunition, it's a bargain. It's a bargain.
Well, tell me about the Educational Ambassador Team. What do they do?
And so for SOAR, we have, sometimes there are birds that we are not able to release into the wild, and their injuries are too severe. They can't fly. They can't see well enough. They wouldn't survive in the wild. And so some of those birds, we are permitted with Fish and Wildlife Service permits and permits from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. We're allowed to take those guys to do programs with us. And so, yeah, if I were going to come and talk about eagles to a whole gym full of kids, I don't think that they would listen for more than about 10 minutes. But if I have our education bald eagle with me, I can get them all to be quiet for a long time and listen to all sorts of things that we have to say about these issues. And just general, you know, we do a lot of natural history stuff and try to get them interested in going out and looking for things outside and spending time outdoors. And so hoping to inspire some future bird watchers and maybe some new scientists up and coming.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned a few other groups earlier in the program that you work with. Are there any other groups like this that also do educational outreach and things like that, or do they just help the birds heal?
So most all of them do. Usually that's a piece of the puzzle for most rehabilitators, is to be able to communicate the things that they're finding to the public. And so a lot of rehabilitators, especially ones that are set up as nonprofits and organized groups, will have a way to do presentations and to talk to groups too. Because basically what we're doing is we're like the hospital. So when they take dad in the hospital, as far as, you know, teenagers, you know, what's causing issues for them, we're the same way. What's causing issues for eagles? So we get a little sample of what's causing mortality for wild animals. And so that's a really important data set to let people know. Sometimes we can't. There are just things that we're not going to be able to prevent. Sometimes we have an easy solution. And so the lead poisoning one, getting hunters to switch over to non-lead, and we've actually found that one, hunters' families have a very much bigger influence on them than we do. And so we will talk to kids that are just starting to hunt and talk about our eagle, and we've had reports of them going home and saying, yep, I'm ready to go deer hunting this year, Dad, but we're going to use copper slugs.
That's good.
Dad, kind of, yeah, just a little take back, and it's like, well, okay, because I want to go hunting with my kids. We'll do what they're asking.
Yeah.
And so it works out well to try to reach out to people that know hunters and can do a little influence. The newest thing that we're going to maybe try to work on are bald eagles do get electrocuted, too. And I don't know if people have been watching the Decora Eagle Nest Cam. Are you guys familiar with that? They have
a
web camera on an eagle nest up near Decora, Iowa, so way up in northeast Iowa. And a large following of people now are waiting for the three eggs to hatch. They're already incubating eggs up there. But they have been putting that group, Raptor Resource Project, up in northeast Iowa, has been attaching transmitters to some of the juvenile eagles up there that have come from the nest. And they have had, I think, four of those nestlings now over the last 5 or 6 years that have been electrocuted.
Oh, my gosh.
That's
another one that we can hopefully work on in trying to get perches installed. So the Fish and Wildlife Service actually has plans designed to get to power companies that they can install a perch up over the wires, because the eagles want to sit up on something high.
Mm-hmm.
And if they spread their wings and touch wingtip to wire, the electricity goes through them instead of through the wire and so, but if they can get them perching up a little bit higher, there's not a problem. And so we're going to try to start working with maybe some high school industrial arts classes and getting some perches built and sending those high school kids to talk to power companies. Will be good experience for them.
Yeah, I just found it online here. It says 311 million views.
Wow. That's...
Yes, yes. These eagles are famous. Is the best way to put it. So now be careful. If you start watching, you can kind of get addicted because it's like you're up in a tree and the wind's blowing and it's a beautiful day and the birds are singing. And
it's pretty incredible.
And they are learning so many new things about eagles through this camera and just drawing people in and getting them then involved in some of these action projects that we have going to help eagles out on the ground.
Well, I'm going to post a link to this on our Eco Radio KC Facebook page, along with a link to www.soarraptors.org. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Kay Newman, who is with that group, Soar Raptors. And we're talking about the eagle population being poisoned with lead due to feeding on animal carcasses that have been hunted with lead bullets. Now, you said all of your family hunts, okay?
Yes.
So you're not asking people not to hunt. You're just simply asking them to switch to using non-lead bullets.
Exactly. Yep.
Well, Kay, let me ask you this. Do you think lead bullets should be illegal?
Well,
There's a bad pun there. Lead bullets equal illegal.
Right. Ooh, I hadn't thought about that one.
You can make t-shirts or something.
You have my permission to make bumper stickers with that.
to use that one.
That's good.
Well, and so if you're a hunter, you know, the first thing that my family does early in the fall is they get a hold of the new hunting regulations booklet. And it's about 100 pages long.
Wow.
And they figure out, you know, they have to wear an orange vest. They have to paint orange dots on their deer hunting blind. They cannot shoot within 200 yards of an occupied building. Well, there are a lot of rules if you're going to go out and go hunting. And so in the end, in my opinion, this for us to really succeed, this will probably have to be a rule for people to use non-lead when they're hunting. And in Iowa, we almost did that for our doves. We have not had a dove season here in Iowa for I think, 100 years.
Wow.
Up till about 4 years ago, and they were going to do a dove season, and our DNR commissioners voted unanimously that it would be a non-toxic only shot requirement for the new dove season. And then, unfortunately, the legislature and the governor got involved, who all have degrees in biology. Oh, no, they don't. and that requirement went away, and it was left up to the individual hunter to make that decision. And a lot of areas where people do hunt doves, non-toxic shot is already required because it would be near water, near wetlands, where people would hunt ducks and geese. And so ducks and geese are kind of waterfowl are kind of our model to look at. And so in 1991, there was a phase-in period, but 1991 was kind of the end date. Fish and Wildlife Service, who is in charge of our migratory birds, and so they're in charge of doves, they're in charge of waterfowl. They said for waterfowl that it would be required. If you're going to hunt a duck or a goose, you need to use non-toxic shot. And what was happening there is that ducks and geese dabble, and they were picking up lead shot in the bottom of wetlands, mistaking it for seed or piece of grit, and eating it and dying. And they were having very, very large die-offs of the very animals that they were wanting to be able to have to hunt.
Mm-hmm.
So ducks and geese were dying off. And actually, eagles come into play a little bit there in that there was a lawsuit that was threatened. They were going to sue the Fish and Wildlife Service for non-enforcement of the Endangered Species Act because eagles will scavenge on a duck or a goose also. And at that point in time, in 91, eagles were still on the endangered species list.
Hmm.
And so Fish and Wildlife Service said, okay, no lead for waterfowl. And they have done studies on the Mississippi flyway and are estimating that we saved about 1.5 million ducks
wow.
each year just by not poisoning them by using non-toxic shot for waterfowl hunting. So the Fish and Wildlife Service is touting that requirement as cost-effective conservation.
Mm-hmm.
Because think about how large of a wetland area you would have to own and manage and conserve and deal with in order to produce 1.5 million ducks.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we did it just by not poisoning them. So I think that we should do the same thing for the eagles and the same thing for the doves and the same thing for the pheasants, because those guys all are known to pick up shot and eat it. Our upland birds do the same thing. They look at the shot laying on the ground and they think it's a seed and they pick it up and eat it. So at this point in time, we're poisoning as many mourning doves as we harvest. So about 3% of the population is harvested. About 3% of the population is poisoned by eating lead pellets. And so to me, as a hunter, that seems like a waste of my resource. I would much rather have those doves out there flying and be available for harvest rather than being poisoned and then having a Cooper's Hawk, which we have had that happen too. A Cooper's Hawk came in with number 7 lead shot in his stomach. I'm sure he had, and they're a little hawk. And so a wounded dove would be like a tasty treat for those guys. And so peregrines, merlins, Cooper's hawks, kestrels, those guys would all be susceptible to secondary poisoning from a dove that has lead shot in him.
Incredible. Okay, we're going to take our final break before we come back and wrap up with you. So we'll be right back.
All right.
Fighting Goliath, Part 2, The Growing Resistance to the Tar Sands on Making Contact, Thursday afternoon at 12:30.
Hi, this is Mike Murphy. The last time I saw Rob Amerine was at the Elders KKFI benefit back in December, and Rob asked me if I'd be the contact person to announce his funeral arrangements. Well, unfortunately, that day is here. Rob passed away on February 26th, and his funeral will be at All Souls UU Church on March 20th. Light refreshments start at 2, followed by a memorial at 3, and a wake and reception at 4. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Pear Excellence 2, Crossroads Pollination, continues our series of dining experiences produced by 90.1 FM, pairing 4 courses of Collections American Cuisine coupled with 4 of Torn Label Brewing Company's eclectic beers. Thursday, April 2nd at Collection, 1532 Grand Boulevard. First course and the music of Mr. Rafina served at 7 p.m. Chef Selena Teo and head brewer Rafi Chowdhury will be on hand to illuminate the pairings. Full menu and tickets at kkfi.org/events. Cheers.
Hey, Kay, we've just got a couple minutes left in the program. I was just curious, though, are we going to find out in a few years from now that there's problems with copper bullets?
Think about what your water pipes are made out of.
Uh-huh.
Do you have a copper kettle?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so copper is an element that your body recognizes, and it actually is a trace element that your body needs to have a little bit of copper to operate. Lead has no biological function whatsoever,
right. And
your body mistakes it for calcium.
Oh, that's awful.
So it can't regulate how much lead it's taking in. When you take in copper, and so I've been told by a couple different wildlife toxicologists, oh, yeah, eagle can eat a whole copper bullet. It's not going to be a problem. Your body knows how much you need, and you're going to get rid of the rest because it can recognize what copper is.
Mm-hmm.
No, copper's been around and next to us for a long, long time and with no ill effects.
I know you explained that about lead in the beginning of the program, but it just kind of hit me now that your body thinks it's something else, and so it can't regulate how much it takes in, and then it kills the eagle.
Yes,
that's awful.
Exactly. Yeah. Your body's tricked into taking in too much.
All right, Kay, before we say goodbye, I wanted to just give a chance to let everyone know that they can find out more about what's going on at soarraptors.org. That's soarraptors.org. And you can find out how you can volunteer for your group. And they also could use help in other ways. You can find out. Okay, is there anything else that you would like to share with everyone?
Well, I hope that everyone will spread the word. Everyone knows somebody that likes to go out and hunt. Contact your favorite hunter. Take them shopping. Mm-hmm. Make sure that they have the correct non-lead ammunition for whatever gun or whatever season that they're headed for. And that people need to get outside and enjoy the resources that we have. And eagles have already migrated north. I bet they've kind of left you guys, too. They just left us here a couple days ago. And so most of the eagles that we have here that winter are headed up north to nest.
All right. Well, good luck to the eagles. Good luck to you. Thank you so much for the work that you do. And thank you for joining us tonight.
Sure, no problem.
All right. Thank you, Kay.
Good night, Kay.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
This is Naturally Again, and I have some of your environmental events you can participate in around town. The Spring 2015 Transit Stakeholder Forum, hosted by the Mid-American Regional Council. At their previous Transit Stakeholder Forum, participants tackled the topic of the future of smart moves, the region's long-range transit vision. This forum will follow up on feedback received in that meeting and online. But during this current forum, facilitators will engage participants to consider the goals of the long-range transit vision update and Ride KC Workforce Connects, the Tiger 6 planning project that proposes to increase the access to employment by transit over the next 10 years. Staff will present proposed tasks, outcomes, and milestones, and will ask the forum participants to provide feedback on the direction of this important work. Feedback from this discussion will be used to develop the final scope of work to be carried out by qualified consultants. There will also be an open dialogue with transit providers about current transit issues that participants would like to address. You can join them on Thursday, March 19th from 5 to 6:30 p.m. at the Mid-America Regional Council Conference Center, which is located at 600 Broadway, Suite 200 in Kansas City, Missouri. The transits they'll be discussing are like the Joe and the Metro and the Max Bus. If you are unable to attend and wish to submit a comment or question, send an email to smartmoves@marc.org. The Lakeside Nature Center will take hikers through Swope Park trails with a naturalist. All hikes are free and open to the public and have early out opportunities for those who wish to complete their hike before noon. Some trails require a short drive from Lakeside Nature Center to the trailhead. Dress appropriately for the weather of the day. Carrying water is also recommended. This free event will be held Saturday, March 21st, 10 a.m. at Lakeside Nature Center in Swope Park, 4701 East Gregory Boulevard. You can find more information by visiting the Kansas City Parks online. Also on Saturday, March 21st, if that's not your cup of tea, there's Seed Saving 101 from 2 to 4 p.m. Seed Saving 101 will teach beginners how to save seeds from their gardens. The class will cover why seed saving is important, how to save seeds, and will include demonstrations of different seed saving methods. This workshop is hosted by Seed Savers KC. Seed Library is on site, and the class is held from 2 to 4 on March 21st at Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center, which is located at 4750. Truce Avenue. For more information, please visit seedsavers-kc.org. That's all for the events, and we'll go out with This Week in Water.
It's the Ides of March edition for the week ending March 15th, 2015, and California is getting the warning.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
This week we begin with the same warning that was issued more than 2,000 years ago, beware the Ides of March. But instead of an impending assassination, today the caution is being sounded about the condition of California's water supplies.
Writing in the LA Times, Jay Famietti, the senior water scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, warns that California is drying up. There's only about 1 year's worth of water in California's reservoirs.
And the backup plan of pulling up groundwater is rapidly becoming infeasible, as over-drilling has led to severe depletion.
The NASA scientist is recommending immediate action, including mandatory water rationing. But as this warning is made, local governments have been reluctant to enforce water restrictions.
There is at least one exception. Santa Cruz has issued $1.6 million in fines, leading to a 30% decrease in usage during last year.
According to the Associated Press, Los Angeles sent more than 5,000 warning letters, but issued only a pair of $200 fines last year to its customer base of over 4 million people.
So we will have to wait to see if all of California begins to pay attention to the Ides of March warning. In a remote area of northwestern New Mexico, there is a national historical site called Chaco Canyon. From about 850 to 1250 AD, it was a sacred meeting place for thousands, but the cultural park and its environs are in danger.
Oil and gas drillers are planning to frack close to the canyon, which is listed as a World Heritage Site by UNESCO and an endangered site by the National Trust for Historic Preservation.
Last week, a suit was filed in Santa Fe against the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Department of the Interior, which have opened up the area to drilling. The suit was filed by Western Environmental Law Center and Wild Earth Guardians on behalf of various groups, including a Navajo environmental organization.
According to Wild Earth Guardians, the BLM has approved more than 130 new fracking proposals within 20 miles of Chaco Canyon, but the agency acknowledges that it never analyzed how this development will impact public health and the environment and has no plans in place to protect the region's air, water, and communities. Last week, two discoveries were made that prompted the New York Times to declare, "Suddenly it seems water is everywhere in the solar system."
First, scientists reported they found evidence for hydrothermal vents on a moon of Saturn. If confirmed, the moon known as Enceladus would be the only place other than Earth where chemical reactions between rock and heated water are known to occur, and could make that moon a promising place to look for life.
And it was also learned last week that there were signs of an ocean under ice on one of the largest moons of Jupiter, Ganymede. Scientists are already convinced that Europa, another Jupiter moon, has a large ocean covered by ice.
The ocean on Ganymede could contain more water than all of Earth's surface water combined. Scientists think the ocean is about 60 miles thick, 10 times the depth of Earth's oceans.
All the snow on the East Coast this winter might have left residents there with a bad taste in their mouths, literally.
Two New Jersey water companies sent out notices to customers last week alerting them that road salt runoff had made its way into their water supply.
While snow itself can be hazardous for drivers, snow melt that is contaminated with road salt and other pollutants such as oil threatens public health and the environment.
There is a growing awareness about the damage road salt poses, not only to drinking water but also to vegetation and wildlife. A recent USGS report found that in many of the streams tested for their study, concentrations had exceeded those that are harmful to aquatic life.
That report and others indicate salts remain in groundwater for extended periods, well after the spreaders are gone for the season, and removing them is difficult and expensive.
What to do about this mounting problem? Listen to our current story, The Hidden Cost of Road Salts, to hear what researchers are doing to keep us safe yet protect our water supplies.
So finally this week, if road salts keep drivers safe by lowering the freezing point of water, slowing it from turning to ice, can seawater freeze?
Our friends at NOAA explain that ocean water can freeze just like fresh water, but at lower temperatures. Fresh water freezes at 32 degrees, but seawater freezes at about 28.4. When seawater does freeze, the ice contains very little salt, because only the water part freezes. It can actually be melted down to drink.
We tell you this because last week, huge chunks of ice washed ashore along Cape Cod. Months of bitter cold created enormous sheets of ice in Massachusetts Bay that were then carried by currents to the Cape.
Technically, these chunks aren't icebergs, which are defined as large pieces that break off glaciers. These are fragments deposited by the tides. As the tide goes out, they're left on the sand. When the tide returns, they move up the beach.
An eerie phenomenon that had many flocking to the Cape last week to see the once-in-a-generation event. Others, given the brutal winter that hit the region, probably flocked to Florida, hoping to never see the white stuff again. This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more at coloradowaterwise.org.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.